Well, thanks. And thanks for having me back. It's really great to be back after 3 years and to speak to this mixed audience, biology, theory. So I tried to reflect it in the title and come back to that during the talk. And want to start with something more general. What are we really interested in the lab has to do with the notion of time and timing in development. So we studied vertebrate embryos, mouse to 90%. And we want to ask, how are these signaling machineries that we know operate within the embryo and that underlie patterning, how are these signaling machineries characterized from a temporal timing point of view? So if you think about signals that oscillate, and we will talk about these here in the context of segmentation, if you think about the signal that oscillates, then you can ask, okay, where is the information encoded? Is it the strength, the presence, the absence, or is it possible that actually the frequency of this oscillatory signal encodes information? If you have multiple oscillators, you can ask, is there something like a phase shift between oscillators that can encode information? And these are the kind of questions we want to address. And segmentation is a good entry point. So I will try to give an introduction to that. Please interrupt at any point. Segment formation in vertebrates is the periodic segmentation of the mesoderm into somites. And somites are the precursor of our vertebra. And this process is interesting because it's a directional process. It occurs from head to tail in a periodic manner. And that means that from a cell, from a subset of cells here in the posterior end of all vertebrate embryos called the presomitic mesoderm, these are mesodermal cells, undifferentiated, proliferating. From these cells, every 2 hours approximately, 1 to 2,000 cells bud off and form this organ, this segment. And then another 2 hours later, the next group of cells buds off, and again and again. It's a periodic process that takes place from head to tail. Now here I put down the periodicities. It's roughly 2 hours. It's not precise at all. Early on in development, it's slightly faster, 1.2 hours. Patrick Tan told me a couple of weeks ago, so not 1 hour. Then it slows down to 2 hours, then 3 hours. So you see already this is a periodic process, but it's not very precise in its timing at least. Now, what is interesting about this directionality and periodicity?
Wait, Alexander, you mean constant? Because it could be that somites on 15 from the vertebrate embryo form with a 1.2 hour period, very precisely.
Yeah. So within, that's a good point. So if you compare different embryos, I mean, no one really think measure that at least in mouse embryos, yeah. But at least within one organism, it changes over developmental time. That's the point. You know, if you hear, and this is what I will later describe, or people describe as the clock, the segmentation clock. If you hear clock, you think about precision. You think about circadian clock, which is so precise. This is different. And you see that already if you see just that it varies from 1 to 3 hours over developmental time. Precision is at a different level. You're right. We will come back to that, yeah.
And the number of somites, is it constant?
The number of somites is, within a species, rather constant. And in this, in the mouse, it's about 55 to 65 in this range. And that number is constant. The identity of segments, that can vary. But the somite number is constant. And I will come back to that. So what is interesting about this formation, okay, it's a periodic process. But what we know since actually decades is that this periodicity and the directionality, the information for that is within these cells, in the unsegmented cells, in the presomitic mesoderm cells, the information is already encoded. And that means that when people took out these cells from chick embryos, from mouse embryos, from other vertebrate embryos, they took these cells out and put them in a petri dish. They could see that in a petri dish, segmentation occurs periodically. And then they took out not all cells as one piece, but made two or three pieces out of them in different petri dishes. And what these people saw decades ago is that segments formed in the right directional periodic fashion. There's a couple of papers where they tried to take these cells out, that was in chick embryos, and flipped it around, put it back into the embryo, healed it with the ectoderm, and now segments formed, as you can imagine, are from posterior to anterior. I thought that was actually quite striking. I mean, it's only two or three segments. These are papers from...
How many cells is that?
One segment in this context is about 2,000 cells.
So these are very small blocks of tissue?
These are blocks of tissue that bud off. These are many cells that go from a mesenchymal state to epithelial state. There are a lot of cell biological changes happening. But now I refer to the formation per se. What is controlling the formation? And that seems really intrinsically timed within this population. And back then, it was already clear that at least information from the outside, from tissues neighboring these cells, is not required. So information is intrinsic to these cells. And of course, then in the 60s and in the 70s, there were many models proposed to explain these and other findings. And many of these were proposing that there must be a timer, a clock, that is ticking within these cells and will control the onset of organ formation, segment formation. So then in the late 90s, there was a really breakthrough discovery from the Pouquier lab. And what they found is what we now call the segmentation clock, the molecular correlate of that. What they found by doing in situ hybridizations for genes such as, for instance, lunatic fringe, that these genes show a very dynamic and variable actually pattern in the presymmetric mesoderm. So in these cells, they did not segment off. You see here, mouse embryos, same stage, completely different in situ hybridization pattern for the mRNA of this gene. And why that was seen, I think, by many people, what they then were really, that was the breakthrough discovery or actually thought, actually, is that this is not just variability. This is the reflection of dynamic changes and actually oscillatory periodic changes. So if you could wait just a bit more, this pattern will then change into this pattern here on the left. So the underlying reason for variability is actually oscillatory expression. And that has been confirmed since they saw these findings, these patterns, and explained them in this way. Many other genes have been identified. And at least in the mouse, we know now that three major pathways, the Notch pathway that we heard a lot about already, the Wnt pathway, and the FGF pathway, all these three pathways oscillate with a periodicity of 2 hours. And oscillations in that context means is that if people analyze downstream targets at the transcriptional level, you see that these transcripts go on, off, in presymmetric mesoderm cells.
Do you mean zoos are necessary for oscillation? Or do you mean that there's a clock that talks to those? Or?
Those, you mean the pathways?
Yeah. Identify the minimal clock you need to show that if you remove something.
Yes. So that has been best shown for the Notch signaling pathway. That pathway has been shown beautifully that it has an internal clock, which is made up by delayed negative feedback loops. That means some of the targets being activated by the clock repress their own activation. And I'm sure Andy will talk about this on Monday, maybe. So that, I would say, is really the defined core clock of the Notch signaling pathway. And it is clear that this pathway is the one that is conserved in all vertebrate species where this has been studied. That pathway oscillates. For the other pathways, actually, we don't know much. We know that if you look at the output, if you look at the direct target, for instance, Wnt, I will show you one target, it's called Axin 2, is a direct target. It's activated by Wnt signaling, and this target now goes on, off, on, off. But what really the loops are and how this is generated is not clear for Wnt, and it's not clear for FGF. So quite a complex network of three pathways, and now it depends which method was used, but some microarray studies indicate that the number of oscillating genes might be close to 100 genes. It depends, again, what method has been used. But it's not a few, it's many genes, and they go on, off, rhythmically. So that's the segmentation clock. Now, we spent a lot of effort in the mouse context to make these oscillations visible. And, of course, for the mouse, you have not only to generate reporters that visualize activity of the pathways, but also you have to be able to culture these embryos on stage, and you have to combine different environmental control systems. But if you do that, then first of all, you see now in this framework only the posterior part of a mouse embryo at day 10. So this is a day 10 mouse embryo. We take this posterior part. And I should mention that here in the tip of the tail, there's a population of progenitor cells. And as long as you maintain these progenitor cells intact, the tail will grow, even if you detach it from the rest of the body. So actually on this here, we did detach it from the rest of the body. There is no heartbeat. Imaging is easier. And what you will see now over time is that there is growth. But most of all, you will see that up here in the anterior part, you see here, a new boundary formed. The next, down here is the time. So approximately every two and a half hours in vitro, of course, you get this organ formation. Now the key was, of course, to go molecular. And for that, we generated several reporter lines. The first one was a reporter called Luvelu that I will use a lot in the talk. it actually uses enhancer promoter fragment from the gene lunatic fringe. That we were lucky enough, other groups, David Ishorowitz and Thomas Folk group, they spent years on finding these enhancers. And so we were lucky enough to use these enhancers, and they drive a very destabilized version of Venus fluorescent protein. It's destabilized at the protein level and at the RNA level. And it's obvious to you that if you want to see pulses of two-hour periodicity, you have to have a very destabilized reporter. And that's at the same time the challenge that we're all facing. How do you get it dynamic enough, but still actually visible? Because, of course, this is a very, very dim reporter. So we combine that with two-photon imaging. And now what you will see are these pulses in the way of lunatic fringe activity, and lunatic fringe is a direct target of notch signaling. Okay, so have a look at this movie, and you will see that there are waves of activity sweeping through this tissue. Here's one, sweeping through, and it stops. You see the next one? So for us, that's now a while ago, but that was really a key moment. And I will play that movie, maybe even backwards. Look at these waves. I mean, we watch these every day, and I think this is just amazing if you consider that. Okay, so these here now, these are about 20,000 cells. And this activity wave sweeps through these cells. And what we see is the lunatic fringe activity. And we will talk more about these waves and what they really are. But just to say that it's obvious to you that now if you quantify fluorescence in one spot, you can now measure the oscillations. This is in a group of cells, so it's averaged over many cells. But still, you know, the signal is very, very, I mean, striking how oscillatory it is, how clean it is, actually. You can measure the peak-to-peak distance. You see, actually, that if you measure in one region in this prismatic mesoderm, the period here in minutes, and that's just one sample, increases over time. And that's actually a very fundamental behavior, that if you look at groups of cells, they will slowly, actually over time, slow down their oscillations. And so you also have different periods depending where you look in the tissue. It's very a complex process here.
When you say a fixed point in space,
say that again.
When you said a fixed in one fixed point,
yeah,
relative to which part of the
That I mean absolute. Let's say I cannot claim we track single cells, but let's say you track a group of cells, and they don't move much. Let's say, and if you track this group of cells over time, you see that their oscillation slows down. I'm saying that because it's really a matter of reference frame here. Where do you measure? But if you measure in a group of cells, it's clear that they will slow down. Slow down, slow down, and then they stop. And when they stop, they make the organ and start differentiation. But what?
Using the lunatic fringe 3' UTR on the RNA, is that just for destabilization, or is there some interesting regulation of the RNA?
Actually, there could be interesting regulations. There are several groups working on potential regulation also by microRNAs. Back then, we used it because we knew that this destabilizes, the mechanism of which, as I said, we didn't investigate, but there could be. Now, what I wanted to point out is really the waves. So what is it actually that is appearing to travel here? So we call them phase waves. And these are very different waves than, for instance, trigger waves that we heard yesterday. So a trigger wave is clear. It's a trigger, a relay mechanism where one kind of position, a cell, activates the next. That's a trigger wave. It's a relay mechanism. Phase waves are quite different. Phase waves are generated by oscillators. Every position is an oscillator. And simply by oscillating out of phase from each other, you generate a wave. So let's say everyone is an oscillator, stands up and down rhythmically. If you create a phase shift between the elements, you generate a phase wave. And again, that's very different from a trigger wave. And why do people think these are phase waves? I don't show the experiments here, but if you did, and we did that, and others did that before us, if you did separate cells here, or you put a foil in between, or you put a barrier in between, what you would see that in the short term, the wave would start here in the posterior, and it would just pass the barrier. It would not stop at any physical barrier you would put in.
Please, so Suzanne. If you could somehow stop cell division or growth and stop it from lengthening, so you're now perhaps inhibiting this change in the phase.
Yeah.
Would you then have synchronous oscillations? Can you?
Yeah, actually, so cell cycle is in the range of 10 to 12 hours in this context, and it is thought at least that it's not required or connected directly to this observation.
Although you're getting growth, and then presumably there's some signal posteriorly that the further away they
That's connect. Correct, but you could also cut away the tip here, and then you have no growth anymore, because that's where also the progenitor sit. You would segment off what you have, but you would still see waves just as before. So for the wave appearance, you don't need growth, and apparently you also don't need cell division. There are some mutants in fish where this has been analyzed, and that seems to be disconnected from that.
So to have wave propagating instead of constant oscillation everywhere, you must have a gradient of something to break the symmetry of
That's correct.
Wave.
And there are two possibilities here. So one is that you have a gradient of phases, actually, just a phase shift. So imagine we all stand up every 2 hours, but we are phase shifted. So the gradient you describe would be just phase.
Wait, but this you have to explain how it's maintained, right?
That's true. I'm just disputing. Yeah, that's option number one.
Well, that's a fact that the phase is
different. Yeah, but that's the second option, and that actually applies to us. And that is, you also generate these waves if you have a frequency gradient. So, and that means if we differ in frequency, then you generate phase waves immediately. So whenever you have frequency gradient, you have phase waves, but it's not the opposite, it's not true. In our case, we do have a frequency gradient. And then the question is, how is this frequency
coupled? Also, when the oscillators talk to each other, could be asymmetric.
Could be. But that's the thing. So here, the frequency is different than here, and that underlies as well this phase waves that you have as a description. It's a description of the system that we did here. Please.
Yeah, so there's a gradient of FGF, right?
Yeah.
From posterior to anterior. Have you looked to see if that regulates the phasing of the...
Yeah, actually, we did, actually. And I don't show the data here, but... So traditionally, the FGF gradient, of course, is essential to control this differentiation, and it's essential in the sense that it's considered to control where segments form. And traditionally, it has been seen not to affect the clock function. And these are experiments that date back quite a while where imaging was not possible. What we see now, if we perturb FGF signals, that we also change this frequency of individual cells. I don't have the data here, but these things are clearly linked. So the FGF gradient impacts clearly on this oscillation behavior. Yeah.
So if I understand you correctly, trigger waves, the cell talks to one another. Mm-hmm. But in phase wave, the cell oscillates individually, but they respond to an external gradient.
Not necessarily. I mean, they're different. It depends on which system we talk. In a phase wave, you're right. Strictly speaking, you could have a system where each element is completely autonomous, as long as you manage to set it up precisely enough, which raises the question how you would do that. In our context, it's not like that. We know that cells are connected via the notch signaling pathways, and the coupling between cells is actually very important. Still, and that's a bit, in the field, that's how the field started off. In the field, this early cutting experiment and isolation experiment indicated that every position is a clock and can do it on its own. The first paper actually showing oscillations in the mouse by the Kageyama group went on and made single cells that might be connected to your questions. And if you make single cells and put them in a dish, they oscillate up and down. It was very noisy and they didn't do for long, but every cell can oscillate. So in our system, they do communicate. And I will show you in a second why that is very important.
Sorry, what is the proliferation? Is there a proliferation gradient that's highest at the posterior and moves more?
Actually, when we try to stain for mitotic cells, for instance, we don't see a great enrichment in the posterior zone. It looks rather uniform, actually. But these progenitor cells, they have been clearly defined, and these are cells that sit here. And they have specific properties. These are the cells I mentioned to you give actual rise to both mesoderm and neuronal tissue. That's a different population. But growth, per se, is not, at least in the mouse, not clearly graded. So question
could it be that the first wave is a trigger wave, and then from there you have a phase wave?
That could well be, actually. I don't show that as well today, because I didn't know about the banana, but I didn't want to put too much in. but it's true that if now we look at the number day 10, and it would be really interesting to see that movie in day 7 in this case, because that's the first wave that happens. And Henning in the lab is trying to see these very first waves, which are more challenging to see, and to ask, how do you set up the system, right? Once it's running, it's one question, but how do you get it first in place? Do you start with a trigger and then it changes? That's we don't have the answer for that in the mouse, at least. More questions?
Just
what kind of information do we have on the nature of the cells that are in this region? You said that there are progenitor cells in one particular.
Here, you mean?
But then, is there a gradient of in the the kind of population of cells that you have within this? So, is it possible that the frequency depends on the type of cells you have?
Yeah, I mean, so type of cells, it depends on which level of analysis you take. These are all mesodermal cells. They all proliferate. They can give rise to various tissue. Most of them, the more you go anterior, the more they are destined to make somites. But there are many molecules and other gradients that are graded. FGF was mentioned. That's different. But for instance, also adhesion is greatly graded. You have highest adhesion in the anterior and lowest in the posterior. Other people describe motility gradients. So the cells are quite different in terms of their behavior, also in the cell biology, from posterior to anterior. Now, how that connects to this frequency gradient functionally is not that clear. Yeah. And we're just starting now by using these tools, and Andy will show that on Monday, using these tools, and then go back to the question, how would these molecular players actually interact functionally? That's still not that clear. Please, yeah.
These experiments where you have only one cell, as the frequency slows down?
These experiments back then were not good enough to say that because it was so noisy, actually. And that was not that clear. Actually, it could not be addressed by the assay because they did 1, 2, 3 bursts, very irregular within cells and between cells, and then that was the end. Yeah. Okay, so these are the notion of phase waves, and it is true that in the short term, they do behave different than a pure trigger wave. But of course, there are many caveats to this interpretation, and I will show you some recent findings from our lab. Okay, so one thing we did when I started at EMBL in Heidelberg, and that's already now 7 years ago, is that we thought, okay, let's think about the waves, more about the waves. I mean, of course, the notion of a clock is very attractive. The clock controls the timing. But what about these waves? What about this frequency gradient? How does that actually fit together? Is that really just a clock? I mean, for a clock, you could ask all cells to be with the same frequency. But now we are saying some cells have actually a frequency that is different from the frequency of segment formation. And it's still an interesting question to ask. And so we wanted to actually generate a system that is simpler than an embryo, but still kind of shows this exciting features. And so we generated a 2D model of segmentation. To do that, we take cells out of the embryo. We cut out a small population of mesodermal cells. And actually, we do include the posterior tip where these progenitors sit. So here's, so we cut them really off physically, either kind of one section or the whole butt. Here it's a butt. And now you look at the cross section. Here's the end of the neural tube. Progenitors would sit here, ectoderm in the middle, mesoderm, and then you let it spread on fibronectin coated cover glass. And these cells do what embryonic cells should do. They spread, they remodel, they divide. And you see here in the periphery, you can see this is here, it's really a monolayer of cells. Of a sheet migration, and in the middle, it's a couple cell layers thick, actually. Now have a look on the right. This is Louvillou, notch signaling. And of course, we were hoping to see oscillations. Here's 1, 2, 3. But look what happens now. You see this transition now? This was really, in a way, a surprise to see these new patterns forming. And the movie will loop. The end is not so clear. This is ours again. Here, pulse, pulse, pulse. And now you see more and more from the inside to the outside. Quite coherent waves sweeping through these cells.
But if you look at the velocity field in the cells, and I mean just at the cells themselves, and then you look at the waves, is there any kind of correlation at all with the direction cells are moving and how?
Actually, we haven't studied that much, actually, and I know we should, actually. The thing is that after some hours, let's say 18 hours, there's no further growth. And that's actually the time point we analyzed most our experiments. But definitely at the beginning, you have this quite nice flow, very directional in a way, to the outside, and then you see the waves. And these waves show the oscillations, underlying, of course, again, oscillations here. The raw, these are actually the photon counts. This is the raw data. Look how, in this area here, very regular oscillations for about 30 hours. And then we have to start a new experiment. then the cells are exhausted. Hervé?
What is the difference here that makes these oscillations very regular in time compared to the mouse? You showed that the period increases.
Yeah, actually, thank you, Hervé. That depends where you measure. So here we measure pretty much in the middle, and there the period is rather fixed, and it corresponds to actually the posterior bud of the embryo, where the period is also fixed. If we did measure here, for instance, then the period would change, just as I showed you in vivo. The period is actually very similar to in vivo. It's 2 hours, 140 minutes. So the period in the center is the same. And then cells do show this behavior and change in the frequency that we see in vivo. And yeah, Boris.
So that sort of relates to Suzanne's question. But at that stage, is there any flow? We're still looking at the same cells oscillating.
Yeah, again, so here I can't claim that these are exactly the same cells because we didn't track cells here. We did do single cell tracking, and then we see oscillations. We see that. But most of our analysis is on positions rather than on identified cells.
And another question is that region of the source there. So what's exactly happening
there?
Lower cell density, or what's going on there?
Yeah, actually,
the dark side.
Yeah, the black, we call it sometimes the black spot, or the black, here I should call it the black hole, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But you see, it's actually filled with cells.
They're coming out of the black hole.
Filled with cells.
Is that where the central nervous system was?
Yes, and so this reporter is negative in the central nervous system. And it's actually very dense with cells, and other markers then do show activity there. It's not only central nervous system, it's actually not clear what these cells are, if these are these bipotent cells or not. But for this marker, it's negative, and the waves emerge just next to it.
You mean the NMPs?
Yeah, it could be, but you know, yes. Okay, so...
Can I ask, if you impair the spreading, will you also impair the creation of these waves?
Yeah, we never succeeded really to do that.
And if you put like a small chamber around this kind of bud, and so the cell just keeps to be compact, maybe it was making a dome.
Yeah. I show you other essays that address that in a different way, but I think that's exactly one of the things we are trying right now. Also, because I told you that this is fibronectin coated cover glass, you can impose some patterns and control where cells can attach. So this is possible.
So throughout the 48 hours, they remain as stem cells, or do they differentiate?
No, these cells are all, I wouldn't call them stem cells, but they're all undifferentiated mesodermal cells. They don't express any differentiation marker. They remain proliferating. The periphery is different. I will show you in a second what happens in the periphery.
So there's no apparent difference between the cells at the source region? Because so why are the waves emanating from there?
No, these cells in the center, they are different. The thing is, we can't really tell you what is different about them. Yeah. So. There is a population of stem cells, they're called MNPs, mesodermal and neuronal progenitors, and they might reside here in the center. But again, we have not studied them in detail in this context. Okay, so very simple 2D essay.
I have two questions.
I'll just move on anyway, but please ask.
A procedure, how much of fine tuning, how difficult it is to maintain this culture, the cells culture like this? And
No, so the assay is extremely robust. So if you do 10, 9 of them will work, and then they will grow for 30 hours, 40 hours.
And you need to treat them with some drugs?
No. Actually, I didn't mention that, but we use chemically defined medium. There is not even serum in there. There's really nothing in there. And the cells do that, and that's what we like about it. Now, there are several labs in the world doing that, and it just works. It's a very robust assay. If you did include serum or other growth factors, you do see other effects. And I'm sure you could also extend the lifetime. And you could also push these cells maybe to become something like a vertebra, expressing maybe even some muscle markers. We never tried. So we keep it very, from that point of view, very simple. And the simplicity is also there. If you want to analyze these oscillations, we can make chymographs along this line, for instance. Our chymographs are this way around, space, time. I think many people do it the other way around. We like to have space, time plotted this way, and now you see these regular pulses and waves. Here you see the waves, and of course you see that the inclination tells you the velocity, you can use it as a velocity, right? And that was back to the question. So back here in the periphery, here outside, cells do slow down. If you measure here oscillation period, these cells will start fast, slow down until they stop. And this is an important region here. I will show you in a second that what happens in vivo is that when the waves stop, you make the organ a segment. And that actually happens also in vitro, and I will skip that. So here you see the waves schematically, and where they stop here, you see? Here they stopped, and you make this segment. You make a physical boundary between cells. And if you look molecularly, so now this is actually a polarity marker. So the segments also in vertebrates are polarized. They have a posterior half, they have an anterior half. And if you look for this polarity marker, look how sharp this is expressed. Posterior half, axon 2, it's there. And I have to say the molecular pattern is much more robust. We don't always have the boundaries. So many of our samples don't show clear boundaries. But you always see this molecular definition of a segment and of a segment half. Please.
You said you're coating it with fibronectin. Have you tried it on a printed strip?
Yeah.
Confined strip.
Yes, we tried that. And we are trying that right now, actually. And I was also keen to talk to others and to Ariel about this. And I mean, there are different versions of that. You can think of... Actually, I will not show the data, but we do it. And there are many things we can do with it. I mean, you can have confined spaces or geometries, lines, and so on. But that's actually something we want to exploit much more.
But it seems that the slowing down, it's already from the origin of the signal, because you have always straight lines. You don't have, like, curved lines.
Yeah, actually, in our system, they're really straight, that's true. But if you measure the origin itself, then the period is very stable. We measure that many times. But you're right, as soon as you leave this zone, you have a slowing down, which we can characterize, of course, based on these chymographs. But, so... Okay, so for us, of course, as developmental biologists, having this in vitro assay or going in vitro was already a big step. And so in that sense, it's important for us that to some extent we do recapitulate what happens in the embryo. Of course, this is 2D, but we do have the oscillations, we do have the waves, and at least to this segment definition, the cells make it. Afterwards, and you see that here, cells die off, actually. They don't proceed. And that's what I meant. If we did change cultural conditions, maybe we could keep these cells alive and push it even further. We haven't tried that.
And this must also mean you get the slowdown without any anterior-derived signal.
That's correct.
It's just perhaps, some gradient from the posterior without the need for an opposing...
Actually, that's one thing we stated about this, because when you start off at the very beginning, there is no anterior in the culture. It's just the bulb. And if you go back to these chymographs, and we did that with the help also of Paul, if you see, this is the early phase, and you see actually this is the growth. You see, the tissue is now really expanding. And at the beginning, it's very hard to say if these are waves or pulses. But if you measure that, you do see the slowing down throughout the entire culture, whether or not there is an anterior or not. Here, that is the part where actually segments formed. You see, this bright spot that formed, this is a segment. And then actually, and I will show that in a second, what happens, I can show it here. So here at this point, this is about after 20 hours, there is no further growth. So what happens is the wave travels to the periphery, it stops, and you segment off. Now the next wave comes, the next, and you see that over time, this field actually shrinks because there are less and less cells that maintain oscillations. So all these cells here on the outside, they're still cells here. They stopped oscillations, and they're kind of lost from this oscillatory field. But you're right, we concluded that at least at the beginning, there is no anterior. So any slowing down should be very intrinsic to the cells. And that's actually a very interesting point we want to further study. What is it that controls the slowing down? Okay, so that's the in vitro system that we developed now quite a while ago. Very robust, we can do many things. And that's one of the things I also would be keen to discuss with you. These are cells that are, it's a monolayer, and you could put anything to them you do to your usual cells. Difference that they show these oscillations and these waves. And obviously, we did address several things. Maybe I can mention to you that, of course, from this kind of chymographs, you can derive not only intensity values, periods, but you can also go the next step and calculate the phase. Here, I don't need to introduce what the phase of an oscillator is, but that's actually quite important for us, that you treat an oscillator as an oscillator and ask, where is this oscillator now? Peak, trough, or anywhere in between, and that's the value of a phase. And this is now a phase chymograph, so we can say for that position, where in its oscillation cycle is this position? Okay, so that is the assay we use a lot in the lab. And we actually addressed two things with it. With this segmentation in 2D, in the last 5 years, we had addressed two questions. And both of that is published. And I want to briefly describe both so that you know what we're doing and as a startup for discussions. But then I really want to go to the new things that we're doing in the lab right now and get your feedback. So we addressed two problems. One has to do with the segment scaling, and I will come to that second. But more recently, we have published a study that I presented actually 3 years ago, the beginning of it, here in Santa Barbara. And that has to do with the question, okay, what is the origin actually of these waves at the beginning? Can we at least use the in vitro system to ask that question? Even if you look at these shapes here, these waves, you know, it's not clear how that should actually emerge in this in vitro setup that is completely artificial. I mean, we put a 3D object on glass, it becomes 2D, and the embryonic axes are completely changed. What used to be anterior-posterior, so if that is the embryo, anterior-posterior, we cut off a little piece. And now you look at this piece, but into out of the plane of the screen was anterior-posterior, right? So the waves used to travel in this direction here. And now they go from inside-outside, you see? It's completely changed the geometry, very artificial. And yet, we have this very coherent waves. How does that fit with this phase wave description, where everything is robust to perturbation? And so we thought about a quite drastic extension of this experiment. And that had actually other examples as a... Yeah, we took other examples, for instance, from chemistry or also from other biological fields as a stimulation and thought, can we actually do the extreme and randomize the entire sample? Can we take these cells at the beginning of the experiment, dissociate to single cells, and put them back? So what would happen? Right. And that's what Harisos did over the last 4 years, actually. And we call this order from disorder experiment. And what you see here is a clump of cells plated on fibronectin. But the key difference to the previous example I showed you is that this clump of cells derived from 10 different embryos, of which we took the entire prismatic mesoderm, dissociated it to single cells, passed it through filters, and then put a clump of it on glass. Okay, so it's completely randomized as much as we can see.
So the entire piece means all of the tail bud, all of the tissue up to the somites?
Yeah, I mean, we don't go into the somites, but let's say close to it, yeah. It's not just the bud, as in the previous experiment. It's really everything. And now you know it's a complete mix of phases, of course, but also of frequencies. The frequencies are completely different. And the simple question back then was, okay, what would you expect? What will happen? So let's see what happens. And you have to have sharp eyes. But I think you do see this four-sided form. And maybe if you look at this one, you see here? If you look at this focus here, I play it again. It's not that easy to see here. Maybe a pulse, next. Next, each of these foci pulses, actually. It's not that easy to see by eye, but of course we can quantify that. And now we can quantify that, and we can also ask, what are these foci, actually? And each of these foci that form, these are now the cells, and then you see the foci here. And each of these foci is actually a small version of a prismatic mesoderm. It expresses all the markers, and I show you only one, that usually are in this pre-Semitic mesoderm structure. And these foci are exactly that. They are miniature versions of a pre-Semitic mesoderm. And each of these foci is oscillating, as I show you here in this chymographs, through this line, two foci, and look at this space-time plot. Again, you see very regular waves within each of these.
Sorry, where are the foci on the... diagram?
So the line is actually exactly this line, which runs through these two. So you would see that's the center of one focus, this one maybe, and this is the center of that one. And so the waves go in both directions. That's why it's symmetric. Thank you. And this is quite confusing. But the point is that within the foci, you have this pulse. And that was already the key result. So we take cells from 10 embryos, everything is randomized, and they get in sync. That goes back to the question, how important communication actually is. We know this is notch dependent. If you perturb notch signaling, this will not happen. Please.
I'm just wondering about the timing of the culture and if it's possible cells are rearranging and that you think they're randomized and that they've actually organized based on it?
Yeah, so we did a labeling of the origin of the cells. And while there is sorting of cells based on where in the pre-Semitic mesoderm they were, anterior, posterior, there is no sorting between embryos. But the origin of cells is important. And that goes back that if you take an anterior PSM cell, it is different than a posterior one. And these cells will sort out over time. So then we repeated these cultures by taking only the very small tip of the embryo, just the butt, and you see just the same. But sorting in this context is definitely involved. Yeah.
But it seems that the waves goes from one boundary to the other boundary, not from the center to the periphery of this fossa.
Well, I mean, there by eye it's not easy to see, but by the quantifications we did, we see actually two things. Let me show you that. It's quite complex, and I didn't want to go into all the details because, as I said, this is out. But what happens at the beginning is that at the very beginning, all the cells get in sync, in phase. And only over time you see these waves appearing. And so if the waves appear, they go indeed from inside to outside. But you know, these are tiny structures. This is 100 microns, you see? There's really not much traveling here. But there are waves there, yeah.
So you said that if you start with only the most posterior cells, you see the same thing, but the same density of foci?
Yes, same. Actually, we measured all of that. Same density of foci, you don't increase the number of foci, same distance between foci. The cultures actually keep going for longer. And that makes sense because these are the cells that usually also have the most kind of potential to grow. But quantitatively even, not only qualitatively, you make the same number of foci with the same distance, the same same outcome in a way. Yeah.
And if you take sort of the most anterior cells?
Yeah, they don't have the potential. On their own, for sure, that will not happen. Usually in an embryo, they have one, two, three more oscillations to go, and they have no potential to show this behavior here. But I'll show you one experiment that addressed this point from the perspective of time. There's a spatial component, of course. You see that there's some spatial arrangement here. There is some typical distance between these foci that is actually irrespective of our starting conditions. So there's a spatial component, but here I address more the temporal component, and that is the question, okay, if you look at different foci, one, two, three, and you plot the rhythm in this carpet plot. So now color is phase, is the rhythm, and each line is one focus, one, two, three, four, five. So you see that these foci are completely synchronized. And the question then is, I told you that because the input has different frequencies, the question arises, okay, what is the new rhythm of this population? We have slow cells, we have fast cells, we mix everything, and the foci are in phase synchronized. But what is the new, as we say, collective period? And that's one of the questions we addressed in this work. And I want to show you the results because they're actually very clear. So what we did to address that was very simple. We took the normal setup, which means the whole PSM, slow cells, fast cells. That's the range of periods we have. Or we take as an input just faster cells. That goes back to Boris' question. And while the outcome in terms of foci, density, and spacing is the same, the new collective period that comes out is different, and that is shown here. So if you take all the cells, the new collective period is the average of the input, pretty much in the middle. If you take as an input faster cells, the new collective period is the average of that input. And then Charisos went on and did a titration experiment. You know, you can take a bit fast, a bit slow, and mix in different proportions, and that is what is shown here. Only fast cells, mostly slow cells, but you need some posterior cells. Or half-half, 80%, you see? You can titrate the outcome of this collective period. And we thought this is actually rather interesting because, you know, we did we did cell tracking and could show that this means that some cells that were slow speed up in this process and some fast cells slow down in that process. And that's why they come out at the average. It's really a nice, fast example of collective behavior here.
So this sort of shows that there's some kind of link between the cells that they want to synchronize.
Absolutely, yeah.
So in the natural case, is there something opposing that?
Yeah, that's a very good question.
Gradient, or
it's absolutely right what you say. It shows, goes back to the question that I think we think the analogy of a phase wave is only capturing part of it, because here this is all synchronization, right? And this, even the frequency we see here is the result of collective synchronization. So then what happens in vivo, where we do see different frequencies, right? And we are just beginning to address that. This is all in vitro. But we thought it's interesting because it shows what the cells can do if you put them on a fibronectin-coated cover glass. Yeah.
So you even get synchronization if you have two foci that don't even touch each other. Is that true?
Yeah, they do actually.
So then does it mean, so what if you had two clumps of cells and the clumps of cells weren't touching each other,
yes,
and you had foci in the two of them? Would they also?
They are. And actually, thank you, Susan, because this plot here, the first four were in one dish, but these three are on a different dish.
What, on a different dish?
Different dish.
Wait, and then?
And they're synchronized, but they had the same starting, the input population was the same. So we have thousands of cells, we put some here, some there, they are in sync. And actually that brought up an important point, because of course we were worried about this result. It could also mean that what we do really is a global resetting. You know, everyone starts from the same value, right? And so that's why we did this, the next experiment. And that is asking, okay, if we do the dissociation, is there any chance actually to retain phase information? Because otherwise the explanation would be trivial. Why are they in phase if you do a global reset? Excuse me?
You just shock them.
You shock them, right? Yes.
Can I ask you a question, sorry, just about the previous slide?
Absolutely.
What are you plotting there?
This is the new collective period if you're in a clump of cells.
So you've got you've got a measurement on a cluster of cells, a group of cells.
Yes.
And over time you get a period. And then what's the error bar here?
So the error bar are the measurements, but you mean the red one?
Yeah.
The red one is kind of the calculated average if we took the input as a starting population.
Right.
So we compare the mathematical to the outcome. Yeah.
And do you think, so you would say that you're systematically longer than the exact average?
Why, you know, from that plot, we are on each of these bars slightly above, yeah.
And do you believe that?
We discussed that before. Potentially, that's very interesting.
Yeah, because I kind of want to believe it.
Yeah, yeah. I, you know, I'm already so biased. I also think it would be extremely interesting. But that's what we have. You know, you also notice the differences are not huge, right? But maybe we would just have to do more to see if that's really a trend that you're slightly above. And maybe, yeah. Okay, but let me go through the other data because I'm afraid of this banana coming.
Just a very short question about the generation of these foci. So when you plate the cells, you said they're completely mixed. But now you have these foci. I mean, are the cells intercalating and trying to find each other in order to create the foci?
That's what I said. So they don't find each other back from the embryos, of course. That's impossible. And if you start with anterior cells and posterior cells, the anterior ones from all the 10 embryos, they find each other. And the posterior ones find each other. That's true. But if you start only with posterior tip cells, where there is no anterior, you make these foci from scratch, and over time, some of the cells have anterior properties, some of them have posterior properties. But that really happens while the cells are contacting.
And so they make the same T-expressing foci.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Here's the experiment addressing Suzanne's question. That's a very important one. How can that actually be? And so what we thought is the following. Can we actually sort cells based on their phase, or actually reflecting their phase before we start the experiment? And can we use FACS sorting to do that? So let's say we have an oscillating reporter. Let's sort cells with high and low intensity. Think kind of as a reflection of a peak and a trough. Then do the plating experiment so that these cells don't touch these cells in two different plates. And there's a clear prediction what should happen if they retain phase relationship. And this is how the plot looks like. Top four from peak, bottom one from trough. Look at this carpet plot. I thought this was actually rather interesting. I was speaking at an oscillator conference, and someone in the first row said, well, what do you expect? He was a chemist. He said, if you take peak and trough, what is surprising about that? And I thought, well, you know, these are cells that we dissociate, we pass them through filters, we put them on fibronectin glass. And yeah, it's true. They keep peak-trough relationship, but for us, that was an important result. So if you do mix and you get in phase, that really means they do actively synchronize. it is notch dependent. And actually, Christine in the audience, she's following up on that project, and that's also why I show all of that. So talk to Christine over the next weeks. She's using this setup to really ask, okay, how is, for instance, the spatial and the temporal self-organization linked? Of course, related to that is what happens actually in vivo. But even in vitro, you know, we can do these assays in different ways. This is a huge clump of cells. You see this tiling here? That's the scale of a previous image. This is a huge clump for our scales. This is beta-catenin that shows each of these foci. Each of these is oscillating. So we can scale it up in terms of how big we make it. We can micro-pattern it. So I'm curious to get your feedbacks and brainstorm what we could do here. Yeah.
How many cells do you have in a foci, more or less?
Well, you know, the foci actually over time they get also smaller and smaller because again cells are used up. So it depends when you would look. But we can start the initial clump, we can start with something like 2,000 cells, 1,000 cells. This would be close to what you have here.
Yeah. Is the phase also the average? I mean, if you compare the mixture of these two things?
Yeah, Christine is testing that actually. It doesn't look like it is. And that's actually a very interesting point that even from, I mean, I think that's actually very important. What the collective phase is after we do this synchronization. And it's interesting also from a theoretical point of view that on this collective phase, which is kind of the second order parameter in the Kuramoto model, there's not much literature on what that should actually be compared to the input. And now we try to do experiments and theory to see what is the output.
So if you combine the cells that are out of phase versus the cells that are in phase, do the out of phase ones take longer to start oscillating than the in phase ones?
So
they have time to do a calculation.
So if you start the population only with antiphase?
Yeah, if you start the population mixing cells.
Yeah,
and
we haven't done that.
That's
Yeah, we haven't done that. I think also that is an interesting question because you would have a scenario where indeed you are missing all the neighbors that are closer in terms of your phase. You just start with the extremes, and there could be a prediction that that takes longer. Yeah. But we see, yeah. So that's at the beginning. But Christine is doing exactly these kind of experiments. What is the new phase, and what can we learn from that? Yeah. Okay. So that was thought as a short overview of what we do. And so I want to get to the second part, which builds on the segment scaling work that we did. And again, as an introduction, I want to introduce the segment scaling problem in vertebrates. It's a very interesting one. Again, since decades, we know that small and bigger embryos show the same number of somites or segments. That goes back to an initial question. You can have small embryos experimentally, or here in this case, that's a paper from 78. This is a genetic mutant in mouse. These mouse embryos are small, yet they have the same number of somites. And that means that the somite size has been adjusted by some mechanism. It's unclear really what happened, but somite size has been adjusted. And the features of the scaling are actually quite consistent across the species and in this completely different settings. I mean, here, experimentally, genetic. What people found is that the rate of segment formation is the same between a large and a small embryo. The ticking of the clock is not changed, people thought. And actually, what really scales is the ratio between a segment and the presymmetric mesoderm from which it falls. Scaling does not mean that segments all have the same size. Actually, they change across development. You see, even here, the segment size change all the time, and that's true in all vertebrate species. Also here, the segment size change, but what is comparable is the ratio of a segment to the presymmetric mesoderm at a given time point in development. So I show here a plot that we made with previous data from Tam and Gomez that shows developmental time in somites in a mouse, and then you make the ratio between the segment and the presymmetric mesoderm. So here it's about 10%, then it goes 15%, 20%, and then it stays at 20%. So ratio is not constant within one embryo. But now back to Andy's point at the beginning, if you did take an embryo with 30 somites, this somite will have a ratio of about 15%, and a small littermate at the same stage, 30 somites, will have 15%. See, it's a special sort of scaling, I would say, that was described decades ago. It doesn't mean that segments have the same size. Okay? We have to find a good way for that, Andy, for how the scaling we can term. It's not scaling as you see it in other contexts where you have a set of field and you make equally sized segments. This is completely different. Also because, of course, you have growth. So while the segments form, you actually actively grow. But the proportions, let's say, are maintained between large and small embryos. And so we thought, now that we have this in vitro setup, and also because this setup shrinks over time, would we see something like scaling? And I summarize this only because this is all out. So what we found is that indeed, if you plot the segment size to the size of the oscillating field in this in vitro setup, it scales. So the segment size is proportional to the size of the oscillating fields. It means that early segments are bigger than later segments, and it is nicely proportional to the oscillating field size. And then in that study, we asked, okay, how can we think about the relation to the clock? As I told you, the classics said the clock is not affected, the rate should be the same. We measure that. Indeed, the rate is the same. But one thing changed quite clearly, and that is actually the wave velocity. The wave velocity, the wave that we can measure at least, also correlates with the size of the field. And that is, in a way, not intuitive. We always say, okay, if you have a trigger wave or another kind of wave, if you throw a stone into a pond, it doesn't matter how big the pond is, the wave will travel with its velocity. Here we're saying the bigger the pond, the faster the wave. And that's what we measured. And that goes back to the fact that this is a phase wave. And we were lucky that in chemistry, phase waves are very well described and how the velocity changes as well. This equation says that you can change velocity in two ways. You can change delta phi phase over t, which is the frequency. You can stand up more frequently, that's the frequency. That will make a traveling wave faster. The second way to change the velocity is by the second term here, delta phi over x space, this spatial phase shift. So keep the frequency, stand up every 2 hours, don't change that, but change the spatial shift. And of course, this is intuitive, this can make the wave much faster. If you stand up all at once, it's clear what happens to velocity. That's chemistry. We measure that in the embryo, I should say we measure that in a 2D embryo. And I summarized the findings of this paper, that is out since a couple of years. What we found is indeed the spatial phase shift between cells correlates with the wave velocity, of course, but also with the segment size. 10 oscillators, 5 oscillators, the ticking rate in the fastest one is the same. The clock in that definition has not changed. But what did change is the shift between the elements. A small shift here, fast wave, a bigger shift, slower wave. And all that was entirely descriptive. There was no functionality that you could derive from that. Entirely descriptive, but it was interesting because it said if we know the velocity of the wave as soon as it starts, actually, because these are quite linear in their velocity, as soon as this wave starts, we can predict how big the organ will be. And that hinted to the possibility that in the wave, there might be more information than just a clock. If you ask, the clock did not change, the velocity did. And so that raised many questions, and I want to get to one today, and that is, how would these phase waves be decoded by cells? Of course, it is also crucial to understand how you get this phase shift controlled, and we're addressing that as well. But today I want to show you how we think there is a way to decode these waves. And it brings me back to the introduction and the fact that there's not only one oscillator. At least in the mouse, we have Notch, we have Wnt, we have FGF. And in fact, we have not only one wave, but we have many waves. So we measure these waves. We made knock-in reporters into the loci of candidate genes. For instance, here, AXIN2, it's a Wnt target. We knock in destabilized reporter sequences, and we visualize these waves. And here I show you an experiment to show you how difficult it is to see actually the waves. You can see segments forming nicely, but the waves in here is very difficult to see by eye. I mean, it's something that, you know, we have to quantify. That's the point. We have to quantify. Even a very trivial quantification here shows you this oscillatory pattern, very rhythmic, every 2 hours. So then we can go spatial and make chymographs, space-time plot for Wnt, space-time plot for Notch. And what we saw from the very beginning is that the Wnt chymographs look different. The Wnt waves, if you look at these phase chymographs, they have a different appearance. They are much faster, That's why you see the angle is different than the notch waves. They occur at the same rhythm, but they travel much faster than the notch waves. And then they have additional features here in the periphery. But the simple observation was that even though they have the same frequency, one notch wave, one wind wave, one notch wave, one wind wave, the notch and the wind waves travel with different velocities. And that, of course, means, and this is quantified here, and that, of course, means that if you now consider the phase shift between these two waves, that changes as a function of space. Okay, so from other data and from snapshots, we think that these waves start antiphase on one side. Wave number one starts, the second one travels faster. At some point in space, these two waves will be intersecting, at least by description. Out of phase here, and the same pathways in phase over there. Again, this is description.
But in the axion 2, it seems there's no waves, it's just a big pulse.
It's true. You can call it a pulse, actually. And that's actually true. If you compare cells for long stretches, they all stand up at the same time. And that's very different from the notch. And that means now it depends where you see it. Some cells are in antiphase, some cells are in phase. We did then a two-in-one reporter where one mouse, so these were two different setups, one reporter each. Here we have reporters in the same animal that took us another year, where actually one is luciferase and the other one is the Luvelu reporter. And we can see the same thing. We can overlay these and we can see, especially where the segments form, that these two waves intersect. So that we can see now in the same samples. The question then is that a way to really encode information? Of course, we can make up this hypothesis that the phase shift could be relevant. But how to test that? And that took us another 3 years, actually. And that goes back also to discussions we had here 3 years ago with Eric also. Can we use actually entrainment and Arnold tanks, that's where they come back, to control the system to ask, is the rhythm actually important?
And why do the wind waves slow down so much at the end? What's that inclination?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is pure description. I would love to know why that happens, you know, but just by description, it happens.
Are they in phase until they get to that point?
So they're in phase before the kink. If I did overlay these two, they would be in phase here.
Before the kink.
Before the kink, yeah.
Yes. Slow down.
And I don't show the molecular marker, but at the kink, then they would also start to express differentiation markers, let's say. And then it slows down, yeah. But I want to keep it to the discussion, is phase shift actually important? Out of phase in the tailbot, in phase where segments happen. And so a really brave postdoc, Ina Sonnen, took up this challenge and managed actually in collaboration with Christoph Merten. Christoph is a specialist on microfluidics, and we thought, can we use microfluidics to periodically flush in actually small compounds that would tickle these pathways and use entrainment to control the rhythm of endogenous oscillators. So she grows these 2D cultures on this chip. Here's the chip, here are the pillars. She can measure endogenous oscillations, and of course now she can control periodically, even spatially, what is in this chip. But here's only periodically. So periodically we can flush in now small molecules that would tickle the pathways, activate or inhibit them. And the idea is, would that be sufficient to entrain the rhythm? And so here what she does is to use a compound, it's called DAPT, it inhibits notch signaling, and she brings that in at low concentration, it's 2 micromolar, it's rather low, and she brings it in periodically, only for 30 minutes, out, in, out, in. In control embryos, the MSO, you see that 3 samples, they just oscillate, rhythmic, but not synchronized. And now if she brings in DAPT, look what happens. These samples get in sync towards what we call the external force, but of course also relative to each other. So these are 3 samples. Now she went on, she did many more samples by now. Controls, beautiful oscillation, but you see no synchrony. Look, and here now she has 11 samples. They get synchronized to the external force. And we thought that is great because that really is able now, by dictating the rhythm of the external force, changing the period, for instance, you can control endogenous clock. Here, for instance, the external force comes in at 130 minutes, so these are the bars here. Controls are slower, about 142, And these down here, they take up the frequency of the external force. Please.
When you remove the external force, how long does it stay synchronized?
Yeah, we didn't do that yet. We always get this question, but Ina is very busy. She didn't do that yet. Okay, so
I'm going to ask the question that Kemi's asked. What else would you expect when you do that?
What else would you expect? No, we would expect exactly that. You're right. If you manage to get them. The theory would expect exactly that, because all this is laid down beautifully in this Arnold tongue plots. These plots are extremely useful. They describe the behavior of two oscillators, extrinsic and intrinsic, and how they synchronize. And on that plot, you have the x-axis is actually the detuning, to which extent the external frequency is mismatched from the endogenous one. The detuning between the two oscillators is plotted on the x, and y is the coupling strength, epsilon. And you're right, these undertongues predict that if you are in this regime here, one-to-one coupling, these two should couple to each other. What is interesting about these plots is that if you go down, so if the external force is very similar to the intrinsic force, frequency, sorry, you see that the tongues, that's why they're called tongues, actually touch this axis here. And that means you need an infinitesimal coupling strength to couple these two elements. And of course, that's used in engineering and other disciplines, right? And so you could say that's what we expect. We expect that we should be able to entrain one-to-one. Now, here you see immediately that also more complex patterns can be generated, 2-to-1, 1-to-3, right? And that's what we tried as well, kind of the higher order coupling. And this is what is shown here. Here, for instance, we show a 2-to-1 coupling where this small compound comes in every 90 minutes. These are only two samples, but these are every 90 minutes pulse. And what you see here is that 90 minutes pulses drive the endogenous system at 180 endogenous rhythm. And you see here in the phase plots that there's really a synchronization between external and internal at 1-to-2. And we thought that's actually exciting because from the theory, that's what you would predict if you manage to be in the tongue. And that might be the challenge. Here's another case. Again, these are small ends, but I wanted to share these recent things. Here's a 1-to-3 coupling. External force 350. These are the bars. And look internally what happens. That's the frequency internally. A third of that.
Please. What if you choose dissonant intervals and not these nice consonant intervals? Does it have a harder time?
Yeah, they don't manage. We use that actually as a control for what I will show you in a second. If you change the period from cycle to cycle, it doesn't
work. Changing the period from cycle to cycle, but these are all beautiful consonant intervals that would be octaves and fourths and fifths and stuff in music. But if you chose like a minor second.
Yeah, not necessarily because, okay, you're right, these are integers as predicted from this theory. But then it depends how broad this tongue is, right? You can move away slightly, you can't be in between. That is true. So you cannot get any in between, suddenly entrainment would stop, and then you have to enter the next tongue. Of course, it's a function of coupling strength that we don't know exactly where we are. We only know that it works. Yes.
And sorry, did you show us examples of learning in between the tongue?
No, I didn't show you that, but we have them. We share as many of them.
Okay.
Maybe did you tell us what happened to the wind oscillator when you synchronized?
I didn't, and I didn't put the slides here because I was afraid of. But what happens actually is if you entrain notch, over time, with some delay, the wind will be entrained as well. And the same is true the other way around. Of course, we can entrain also wind, and we did
is
that.
Is there a systematic phase between wind and notch?
There is. So in vivo, as I said, where the segments form, they are in phase. And in these experiments, this is maintained. So these two will be still in phase at the location where they are normally, and that means that actually the wind will be entrained, we think, secondarily, because it takes longer actually, once we entrain the notch, and it goes in both directions. Okay, but this is really here for the Arnold tongue reason, and also for this quote that I found in Pekovsky's book, that he points out that these higher order tongues might be very difficult actually to get experimentally, so maybe there are not that many instances now also in biology where you get this 1-to-3. I thought that's actually interesting, and this system does it. So we can entrain and control the rhythm, and I think that will be an important avenue for the next 5 or 10 years for us to exploit. Please.
Can you tell us what
Please.
I'm sorry, I'm a little bit confused. In vivo, they're out of phase,
yeah.
And they get in phase.
That's correct.
You're saying in your culture system, they entrain each other.
That's correct.
So they always become in phase. Is there something...
In the same location. So it depends where you look. If you looked in the posterior, they would still maintain the traditional antiphase relationship. And that's indeed the confusing part. They are linked, but they have different phase shifts in the butt versus where segments form. If we entrain and we compare the same location, we have to keep the location straight. Otherwise, if you compare in the same location and we entrain only one pathway, the other pathway will follow and it will look like normally. So they're in phase where they should.
You should have 1 to 3 or 3 to 1?
It's a matter of, you can also put it the other way around, yes. If you put it with omega, then it's the other way around, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, that then the other one was not 1 to 2, but 2 to 1. Yeah.
But it makes a big difference, driving harmonics or subharmonics.
Yeah. I agree. Actually, I talked to someone who... Yes, I agree. But we have both directions. That's what I tried to say. So we have both 1 to 2 and 3 to 1. Now, yeah.
Which is pretty amazing. Mm-hmm.
Which is why I was asking for the intermediate values. The intermediate ratios. Because if you can find all of these tongues, and as Kosky says, they're very hard to find, it might be that it's continuously true. But not.
Yeah, we don't know how they really look, right? How much they overlap and where we are, that we don't know. Yeah. Please, Avi.
That's my question. I mean, if you will be able to tune this coupling parameters. 30-core coupling parameter to the point where the tongues meet.
Would you
expect chaotic behavior, and then do you think you can get out something?
No, I mean, this is extremely early, so that's actually why I show it here. But the point is that, if you have your pre-Semitic mesoderm and you have a frequency gradient, it means also that the detuning varies in space. See? So, depending on the dose we use, we get situations where some regions entrain and some don't. So the simple entraining regime is really complex, and we are just beginning to scratch our heads. If we increase the dose... if you increase the dose, then things change, and we think we move up the ladder, and then all cells get entrained. That's true.
So, sorry, can you just say again how you take the measurement? Because you've got these...
Yeah.
Are these forming the foci?
No. So this is in 2D, right?
This is now...
Not in the self-organization, sorry.
It's a single tail bud.
It's a single tail bud, and we always measure in the periphery where the waves would usually intersect. So let's say we always measure here. This is the best part, the most consistent part for us to measure. So all the measurements I show you also later are taken here in the periphery. Okay? If you move in space, things are very complex, because the detuning is also different. The periphery is quite consistent. I will show you in a second, if you let me...
Why is the periphery not at the... you don't mean at the outside of the culture?
No. Periphery, I mean at the end of the... I mean, actually here, exactly here. I can show you exactly where we measure. It's exactly here, before the kink. Before the kink, that's where we measure. That's where the waves usually are in phase.
And so over time, you need to bring your ROI in follow that kink?
That's correct. You see? Because that is moving. That's correct. Yeah. But my point is that the single entrainment, again, we are just seeing the first, these are the first ones we see. It's extremely complex what happens where. And so,
So does it mean, though, that then you prevent this phase shift from happening if you entrain the entire piece of tissue? Does it mean that now the... it doesn't get slower and slower, the oscillations?
I'll show you some examples. So the way we do it and the way the data I showed today is very low concentrations. And for the Luvilu waves, we still have waves, which already means, they're not all standing up at the same time compared to the external force. At this low concentration, we still have waves. If we crank up the concentration, then they all listen to the external force immediately.
And the ones that are the most sensitive to the entrainment are the peripheral ones?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, we think right now it's the periphery, yes. So at least there the measurements are very consistent. In the center, as I said, it's not so clear. That is not so clear. I couldn't really tell you now exactly what happens in the center at this low dose. Higher dose is easier, but the low dose I showed you today, the periphery is very consistent.
The waves are traveling from the center.
Yeah, it's true.
And then the center is not consistently synchronized, but somehow by the time it gets to the edge, it is.
Yeah, so that's a good point. Within a sample, we see waves, but between samples, and these plots are between samples I'm going to show you, they might differ in the center, but the periphery is fixed. I'll show you the plots in a second.
So then somehow the speed,
that's
your
correct.
Entrainment is adjusting the speed of the traveling.
I mean, if you did measure the wave velocity, that would differ, absolutely. Yeah. But you see, that all depends on where entrainment really happens. These plots here are in the periphery, and the next one I show you as well. And I move to the next ones, because they're actually very clear, if you measure in the periphery. Center is a different story, and as I said, I think that's just the beginning. Okay, so let's move to the periphery and do the following. So here, this is the coupling. So let's do the following. Let's go back to the question of phase shift. Can we now do notch entrainment and wind entrainment at the same time? Because the question I want to ask here is, usually we have in-phase wind segments happen. Can we control this phase shift between notch and wind? Okay, so that's the question we ask here. And to do that, we combine treatment of notch and treatment of wind. I told you that if you do either or, the pathways are linked. But actually, it takes some time for one pathway to follow the other. So here, what we hope to do is to override this link by entraining one and entraining the other one directly. So there are two drugs now. And from now on, there are always two drugs, same concentrations, 2 micromolar, 5 micromolar, same. The only thing that we differ is how we put them in, at which rhythm. Alternating, simultaneous. That's the difference.
One of the knot is an inhibitor and the wind is an activator.
Yeah, that's true. But actually, I can tell you that we don't think that makes any difference. Because that's also...
Out of phase is more like in phase. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But just look at the rhythm and then you will see. Because also the way we put them in at the concentrations, we don't change signaling levels, actually. We put them in short time, very different effect than if you leave them in, as we did in the past. Okay. 30 minutes in, out, and the signaling levels actually don't change.
But I'm saying pulsing with Chiron in between, I would imagine is similar to pulsing with, say, IWP simultaneously.
No, I don't think so, because it's really about the rhythm. IWP we tried, actually, and... Yeah.
Then you should, whether you activate wind on the trough of the, or I guess you're activating wind on the peak of the notch, right?
Yeah, but you're thinking in the signaling direction. So you think of it as an activator or inhibitor. We don't think of this in that way. This is a small perturbation that doesn't change signaling levels, but entrains the rhythm. And we can measure the signaling levels here and here, and I show you that later. That doesn't change. So that's the difference. It's really entrainment and it's rhythm. It's not signaling strength, we think.
When you do this, it entrains it so that the peak is when your activator comes.
Not necessarily. You see, that's also the thing. Look at this here. You see the phase relationship. So here, for instance, okay, you could say inhibitor, trough. Right? It's actually precisely at the trough, which is also not so clear why it should be trough and not after. But look at this one. Of course, it's a 2-to-1 entrainment, and the phase relationship between inhibitor and the signal is completely different. This is entrainment, see? The phase relationship, it's not that you're pushing down, it's not like forcing it. This is rhythm, and here it's not at the trough anymore. And here it's again different. Actually, here it's at the trough in this one. This is a good example. Okay, so let me show you the outcome of that. So here on the left now is always a notch reporter, wind reporter, alternating treatment. And this is a combined 15 samples, the mean and the standard deviation. Always measured in the periphery, so where the segments usually form, okay? Where usually these two are in phase. And what you see here, so the red one is actually the DPT, and the blue one is the, the blue one is the Chiron. And, no, the other way around, sorry. The blue is DPT. It's at the trough, and red is Chiron, exactly. And you see that where the trough here is the trough here. See, so these two, peak, trough. So in this regime, with the two drugs, it's peak to peak, trough to trough. They're in phase. Now we move the drugs, just the drugs. And look what happens here. Same drugs at the same time, notch reporter at the trough, trough, wind reporter at the peak, peak. Okay? And that can be represented in this way. Look at these phase plots between Luvelu and Axin. Alternating treatment, quite nice in phase. Now you change the rhythm of the drugs, and you see how you change the phase relationship between Luvelu, notch, and wind. And I thought when Ina showed that was actually quite exciting for us, because it really seems that we can override the endogenous link by putting the drugs in rhythmically and change the relationship between these two pathways in this spatial point.
Sorry, I'm going to give you a hard time about
this. Please, yeah, I know. That's why I'm here.
One-to-one synchronization.
That's one-to-one. All so one-to-one.
With one-to-one, I would expect peak-to-peak and trough-to-trough. So I would feel better if you would do the same experiment, but use a Wnt inhibitor instead of a Wnt activator.
Yeah. She did that, actually. Yeah.
I expect that when you have a one-to-one ratio, or when you drop in the chironics, you get the peak of the Wnt.
Yeah.
And when you drop in the DAPT, you get the trough.
No, I see your point. I think we should really do that. She did, and I remember she had entrainment. She doesn't have it extensively as here, but we can add this. The point is that here we're using anyway the readout of this perturbation, and so I think from the point of view of phase relationship, it's clear that we can change the rhythm between the pathways. So that's the point of this slide. So schematically, yeah, in phase, out of phase.
I expect them to be out of phase because you're inhibiting one and activating the other simultaneously, right? Here you're alternating between the sign of your perturbations is the same or different depending on the patient.
Okay, but irrespective if you expect it or not, the point is that they are out of phase here, in this.
Right, because you are simultaneously. They can't. Right, I agree. You're still, even though they're coupled, you can get them out.
Yeah, exactly. That's a point.
If they weren't coupled at all, I would expect this result.
Right? Yeah.
You're activating one.
Absolutely. You could say you could expect that. That's kind of a first row. Yeah. You could expect it. Here we take a pragmatic approach and say, fine, if you manage to do that, the point is to ask, would that matter for the system? See? Irrespective now how we did it, actually. The point is that later I show you that still we have to do it in a way where we could say it's just the rhythm that has been changed and not levels. And that I show you later that this is the case. Same concentration, same cumulative dose, the rhythm does change. That's the point. And then the question is, okay, well, what happens in terms of phenotype, and that's the new data that Ina has. And that is shown here on the chymograph. So here on the left is a control, waves, segmentation. Here you provide the drugs alternating, waves and segmentation. And now here you provide them simultaneous. And what you can see here is that you have the waves coming, but you don't have clear segmentation at the time, at least, when you make the normal segments. Okay? Eventually, oscillations stop, and you see that it gets there's a regression, but you don't make proper segments, and I'm going to show you other markers on time. So cells keep going, and when they stop oscillating, they still don't make a proper segment. So there are two effects, as I said. The waves don't stop where they would stop. They keep going in these cells here, and segmentation is perturbed. And for us, you know, if you just change the rhythm of these low amplitude oscillations between two pathways, you know, the question really is, do you expect any phenotype? And I can say that this phenotype, the extension of oscillation by these 2, 3, 4 cycles that we can quantify in many samples, that kind of phenotype has so far only been achieved by throwing high doses of FGF8 on the cells. If you do that, you can maintain cells to oscillate a bit longer. And we did that in the same system, the magnitude of effect will be the same. So here we don't change FGF, we don't change growth factors, we change only rhythm. And so that is one effect, delay of when you stop actually the waves and the oscillations. And the second effect is the polarity that I was indicating. Here's actually axin 2 as a polarity marker, segment, and a fourth. Alternating treatment, same drugs, you make the segments. And if you do it simultaneously, even though you stop oscillating, you never define a proper segment. Here's the slide about signaling levels. Here we compare signaling levels normalized to the control, you see that it doesn't much matter how we put the drugs, which rhythm, in terms of absolute signaling levels. That doesn't change, not even much to the control, actually. So we think, in that sense, it could be the first evidence that this shift between this pathway is functionally important in the cells in the anterior PSF. So that brings me back to a model, again, 69. I wanted to mention that because I find it really, I think that's really, also stimulating to go back to the literature and see that someone thought about this. 69. And he proposed that there are waves, and his model, look how many pages these are. The first 10 pages are really good, I would say, but then he goes, for me, personally, because he goes to a very much detail and becomes, but the beginning is very simple. He says, just take temporally ordered cells, an array of oscillators, and think about a system where you have multiple waves, and he makes up a system based on phase shift to organize space. And here now, the oscillators are not just clocks. They are, in a way, also encoding spatial coordinates. And I thought that's interesting now to compare to what we can do today, quite some time after that. Okay, so let me summarize. I showed you this phase gradient idea, how you can decode these waves, actually, and that could be with help of a second system. And actually, it is the local phase shift within one cell that could encode information. I didn't talk about how FGF and wind signaling are integrated in that. We have the next days to talk about it, and Christine is here. But of course, also very important, what happens in vivo. Back also to the self-organization, how are the spatial signals and the temporal signals actually linked in vivo? And these are the key questions in the lab. And to do that, just to finish with a general approach, this ex vivo approach is new to us now since a couple of years. We do a lot of ex vivo. We try to explore, to discover. But of course, we have to go back to in vivo and to see what is really the significance of these findings we see. And for that, we do mouse, but we also now started recently Medaka as another Telios model. And you heard all the benefits and also some disadvantages I heard about the fish model. But of course, I think that is an exceptional model where we can apply some of these concepts and see, does it really apply in vivo? And with that, I want to thank my team, really highlight also Ina Sonnen. She really drove this entrainment project, really a fantastic postdoc. Christine is here. Talk to her if you want to hear more about self-organization. And thanks to you for your attention. I was close with the banana, huh, Andy? Not too.
It was indeed. Thanks very much. That was very stimulating.
I was wondering, when you showed that the oscillators are able to restore their appropriate phase differences in the advancement just one pathway, you interpret that as the cells having some other request where they are, or are they able to reorganize the normal?
Say that again. I didn't. If I interpret it as
the cells are able to restore the normal phase differences that are appropriate for the position when you entrain them correctly. So how do they know where they are? Do they have some other cue? Other positional cue, or are they able to reorganize the patterns of the
world? Yeah, we don't know about this. We don't know how they are molecularly linked. We know genetically they're intertwined, but molecularly we don't know how they talk to each other. So this is all really open territory in the sense of now we have actually also an assay where we can see the link, and now we have to probe what actually is instructing that. We don't know that.
Yeah, according to this phase shift model, wouldn't you have expected that when you forced them to go into phase, you might have accelerated.
Yeah, you could expect that.
But and you didn't see that.
No, we don't see that clearly. It's not clear why we don't, but we don't. Yeah. And we are trying to force the system into that direction. Again, I told you that with these low concentrations, we have still waves. So that means they're not everywhere in phase. You see? But we can force them to be everywhere in phase, and still we don't see a huge, like you would expect from a simple interpretation. That doesn't happen. If that is because in the posterior you have some factors repressing that switch or not, we have now to see. But clearly that will be a prediction or a correlate to the test we did. Yeah.
Alexander, I had a question for you. Microfluidics experiments and the synchronization. I guess Bitofsky will also tell you about the time it takes to synchronize, right? Mm-hmm. So how many periods?
Yeah, actually, that's interesting. It's extremely fast compared to the time scales.
Yes, in your experiments, it looks like one bang with a hammer is enough, and then it goes in sync, right?
So it's not one, but it's a couple. I think some of the time series showed But still, on the time scales of Pekovsky, you know, their transients sometimes are
much longer.
Yeah, much longer. So we need 2, 3, 4 cycles max, and then they're there, absolutely. So it's very fast. And that's also true, sorry, when we do the self-organization, also there, it doesn't take long at all. You know, in the time scales of periods, of oscillation periods, it's 1, 2, 3 periods, and then cells are synchronized.
Yeah, I guess there's a coupling constant also, which is your concentration, right?
Sorry?
There's a coupling constant which is proportional to your concentration of your drug.
In the entrainment, that is true, yeah. And that we can titrate, yeah.
And also detuning, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And also detuning.
Small is
absolutely
a long time to discover.
That's correct.
So it's so fast because you're probably working with reasonably large detuning.
Right? Yeah. This is something we should explore systematically. We should see that, for instance, if you do with 90 minutes, 90 minutes is quite far away from 140, then the system jumps to 180. So that should take, we should see how long does that take, actually.
But I guess you got a lot of questions about are there these high order tongues, et cetera, et cetera. But right, this requires looking at smaller and smaller detuning, and ultimately your resolution is limited by how long you can keep it oscillating.
That's correct. Yeah, it's correct. But, yeah, we, of course, our transits couldn't be long, otherwise we, this system, 10 oscillations is what we can push it. So it has to happen in that time scale.
Okay, question back.
So I don't know if I might have missed it, but when you add both of the inhibitors, or like the activator and the inhibitor,
yeah.
Did you see higher amplitudes in terms of the oscillation? So then, I mean, that could be like a reason why it takes longer to decay.
Yeah. We didn't see that. We compared amplitudes as well, and just as the overall signaling levels, we didn't see something systematic between the conditions. Yeah.
But when, and if you, I don't know, add some extra notch, some extra wind, just like force the amplitudes to be stronger,
yeah,
would you then achieve the same thing?
We haven't tried that. I think we should definitely try that now. Yeah, with the winds, that's an issue, just experimentally, but we should try that also to distinguish really phase from amplitude and also signaling strength. That's definitely something we have to kind of dissect out what is the contribution of both. Because the amplitude endogenously does change. So I didn't show you that, but an additional component, maybe Andy will show some of that. Not only does the frequency change over time, but also the amplitude does change over time. So that's definitely in the system. And now we don't know what the contribution is of that. Yeah.
Sorry for the biased question. Is there any mechanics, you think, involved? For example, the coupling between the cells? Did you touch any?
No, it's entirely unexplored. We know notch is required. That doesn't mean that it's the only thing. If you paid attention, you could see that density is completely non-uniform. The foci, you can see even by the bright field image, it's much denser, actually. And then, again, within the focus, the density is also not uniform. So we have to explore that. That's not tested yet.
So when you stop the injection of these two drugs, do you get back the in-phase relationship?
We haven't done that. That would be related to even just one drug and see how long the system needs to get back. Two drugs, we have to do it. We didn't do that yet.
This reminds me of experiments done in cicada to see whether the phase free runs or whether it's permanently adjusted to the drugs.
You had this very nice puzzle that you know the number of vertebrae is fixed independently of the size of the animal, and you mentioned that the wavelength of the wave could be size dependent on the size. But you didn't really get back to that point with a hypothesis, or do you have a hypothesis?
Yeah, we do. So actually, you know, it's interesting that the wavelength of the wave, I wouldn't say is size dependent. It matches the size, that's true. But it's also not the same wavelength if you look within one organism early and late. Like, as I told you, the ratio changes all the time. But it is true that the wavelength, I think, reflects the growth. So the hypothesis we have is that, okay, you have a growth process. This is driven by growth factors. And these growth factors, we know, influence these dynamics. So we think that growth is integrated via this effect of growth factors on dynamics and will be reflected at how this phase gradient looks like. So in other words, the shape of the phase gradient will reflect growth. That's an hypothesis. So what we're trying now to do is to change growth and see the effect on this phase gradient. But it's very different than saying the wave I mean, it matches the size, that's correct, but you know, there's no size sensing, for instance. It's not like this structure can measure the size. It's the growth that controls the system, yeah, in terms of shape of the gradient.
But I thought that was the, that was somehow the idea that the, you have to count the number of segments, right? So, and you said that, you know, the period is getting longer, so there is some notion of aging.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that the counting segments is somehow related to this, if you like, aging of something, right? And yes. Otherwise, then you say that, okay, there is this phase velocity, which depends on something or other, and then the 2 pi in that phase velocity gives you the size of the segment.
Yeah.
And then this aging, blah, 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 counts after how many segments you will stop. And that's your size of the animal.
Yeah, again, this 2 pi is not fixed over time. That will change. At the time point when we started, it's fixed for 24 hours, it is. But that will not stay the same all the time. But in a way, that doesn't matter. If it's 2 pi or 1.5 pi, that doesn't matter necessarily. But you're right that there are two timescales. One is kind of the ontogenetic time, how long does this process take place. And there's an overall slowing down over days, that's true. And the other one is within now a shorter time scale, you have these wave things. And I think these are, in a way, two different things, in the sense that the arrest of segmentation at the end of the whole process is an active stopping. So you really shut down the system of elongation. We know that because if you take these progenitor cells and put them back into a young embryo at a time where they would stop, they would populate again the whole axis, and they do it a second time. So these cells have potential to run much longer. So the control of total number, you see, you really have also to stop the process actively. So
tuning your two oscillators could be a good way of
interesting, yes.
Of counting the large numbers.
Yeah, right? That's a good idea.
They'll come into synchrony after some longish time.
Yeah, you should. So that the phase shift in the stem cell population is changing slowly over this ontogenetic timescale. That we should check that.
The frequency and also the phase shift at different temperatures.
Yeah, the temperature issue is very interesting. I mean, the best paper comes from Andy. And that paper from Andy shows... It is also the only paper. That's even more, you know, because he addressed the point. So what is clear is that this clock is temperature sensitive, drastically. So as development is, if you change temperature in fish embryos, segmentation rate will change. These waves will change. Everything will change. But what does not change is actually the spatial arrangement of segments. They come out the same size, and that has been quantified.
Can't tell which temperature you grew it at.
Yeah.
But then the frequency and the change in phase have to...
Now, here's the interesting thing. Excuse me that I interrupt. Yeah. Goodwin, 69. Why did he propose that model? He said one benefit of that would be if you take a relative coordinate system between two oscillators, it's entirely temperature insensitive. As long as you say that both oscillators are changed by temperature in the same way. So the point where these waves meet in space will be the same, spatially. Of course, it will take much longer, he said. But spatially, that will be the same. I thought that was an interesting proposal. So now we have to measure these things. That's why I think we really have to combine also in vivo models where you can change temperature. One reason for us to go to Medaka, there are other reasons. But this Medaka teleosts, they are remarkable in the sense that you can grow them, let's say, from 4-6 degrees to up to 35-40 degrees. Huge range.
So this would also be interesting to know how much a mouse has preserved that ability to make them respond the same to temperature those two, or whether...
Sure, and we tried that, but you know, the mouse is not, you know, you do 2 degrees, 3, 4, but these cells are not. So I think there are other models that are better for that. But that goes back to this proposal that the relative coordinate system could be quite interesting in that regard.
I think we're going to get some lunch. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you very much. questions and please patience. Thank you.